some don't. I'm Peter Mercer Taylor, a music historian at the University of Minnesota. I am best known to those who know me at all in the musicological community as a Mendelssohn scholar. That's what most of my work has been about. But I also have done a certain amount of work on popular music and a certain amount of work, including a few ongoing projects on hymnody. And one of my persistent fixations is the question of why we don't tend to handle hymns the way that most kinds of literate texted music get handled, which is to say, if we're dealing with something like opera, with a piece of classical music with opera, or with a madrigal, or with an art song, most kinds of sort of literate texted music, music that gets written down and involves words, the first question we ask of such genres is, how do the music and the words interact? This is the first thing we want to know about these things. Yet, this is a question that we tend not to ask of hymns on a very regular basis, which is to say, we have tunes that we like, we have texts that we like, there may be different reasons that we will like one or the others of those, but we don't ordinarily ask of hymns, how does this measure correspond to this word or this phrase? How does this piece of compositional decision making help us grasp better, what's going on in this particular, textual event? What finally do text and music have to do with each other? Last time we talked at some length about this very topic and focused in particular on a phenomenon that can sort of casually be referred to as tone painting. And tone painting has a couple sort of obvious guises. For example, if you want to talk about something that is high, if you're using, say, the word arise, if you're using a word like climb or something like that, and you sort of make your way up the melodic scale, this is a kind of tone painting. If you make your way back down the scale for something lowly or something about descent, so it goes. So the second verse of a tune that I grew up singing, till sun shall rise and set no more. This is a classic example of tone painting. We have the rising, we have the setting, and words and music are interacting in this way. And it's that kind of very limited phenomenon we spent most of our conversation last time chatting about. To reanimate that conversation and kick things off from there, I'd like to spend a little while just reawakening our engagement with issues of this kind in connection with this tune, In the Hour of Trial, to see what we can make of this thing, and ask ourselves the question, what finally do the words at hand and the music at hand have to do with each other? Bjorn is a St. Olaf student who has graciously agreed to do a better job than I could at the keyboard, and we thank him for it. Bjorn is going to walk us into this with however many notes he sees fit. We will sing the first verse of this thing, In the Hour of Trial. And I would ask you, as we make our way through this first verse, just to ponder, are there particular words that the music succeeds in bringing out somehow? Are there particular turns of phrase, turns of the English as it moves past, that the words help us grasp or help us to meditate on? Let's dive in.
Particular words that the music helps with.
Well, it wavers on waver.
terrific. Yeah, we have, I mean, the first, as we call these things, melismas, a moment where we have more than one note to a single syllable. That's something we call a melisma. Those of you here last time will recall we had a big, long melisma for the, what was the phrase, the unending kingdom or something. Bjorn, there's a hand up there.
Yeah, trials of minor chord.
Okay. Such as where? In the hour of trial. That's right. You know, in the hour of life is happy, unproblematic, two very nice chords set side by side. When we finally understand what that sentence is about, trial. Suddenly, two kind of wrong notes, two sort of, you know, accidentals, as we call them, creeping in. This very strange, sort of disjointed feeling chord for the trial. Other things that
The text or the notes of the first phrases of the words of the text are all quarter notes, and you got half notes that sort of insist that you really listen.
Great. Yes, and the half notes do have a way of telling us what to listen for. And in music, the theorists will call this a kind of agogic accent, which is to say it's an accent that comes not from being louder, but from being longer, an accent just from sort of lasting longer. Great. Other things that grab you? The nice waver, the nice trial. And there are things like, I mean, the notion of the denial, of the departure. Can we just play that second system again, the second line? Lest by base denial. Of course, there is this feeling of a harmonic departure, which is to say we're starting happily in the key of C, and suddenly we've drifted off into the land of E minor, a pretty strange place. A pretty strange place to go, and this idea of, you know, I depart from thee, you know, I deny thee, you know, we goodbye C major, off we go into E minor. And then the final plea that we want not to be suffered to fall. And the fact that this ends on such a strange note. I mean, the vast majority of C major hymns, as this is, would end on a C. We don't end on a C. It doesn't go, nor from fear or favor suffer me to fall, or something like that. It doesn't ever get down to the right note. It lingers up here straight to the end, suffer me to fall, which is to say the tune is not permitted to fall. We're not permitted to, you know, to get to the last note, to get to that sort of final resolution we might have thought was inevitable. This is an opening exercise. Thoughts before we press on to the real meat of our conversation.
Is that a common merger of text and that sort of chord that sounds like it's unfinished?
Yeah, no, not at all. I mean, that is, you say, at the end of a hymn, I mean, sort of a lack of resolution.
Yeah.
It's a pretty rare thing. I mean, one finds them, including a couple of famous, can I have the keyboard for a second? Sorry. A couple famous cases. The tune that we know as O Sacred Head Now Wounded is not, in fact, in the key most of us think it's in. That is, we like to think of it as being in this key or this key. In fact, the melody itself really is in this key. But it's such an unusual scale, we have a hard time hearing it that way, so it tends to be harmonized differently. So, those tend to be the resolutions that we end up with, ending in, say, C major with an E, you know, stuck in the melody. That's a long story. Forget I got into that. But yes, but very often we'll hear that tune harmonized such that the melodic last note doesn't really seem like it ought to be the last note of the thing.
Another challenge of marrying the text with the melody is what happens on succeeding verses. You match up verse one.
Right.
Two and three and four.
Yep. And, of course, you're fresh off the boat. Had you been here yesterday, you would have gotten about, you know, 20 minutes worth of conversation on this very problem, and which is not to say don't bring it up. I mean, it's central and it remains central. And we'll be coming back to it today. What do you do about the fact you've got all these other, you know, I mean, this works perfectly well, you know, don't suffer me to fall. That works great on the first verse, but it doesn't mean anything when it comes to, you know, cast my care on thee for the third verse. And so we have to decide, you know, what do we make of that? I mean, what do we do with what we call strophic song, which is to say songs that involve more than one text sung to the same melody, where you have only a single verse of music and sing, say, three verses to that same chunk of music. Nearly every hymn in the hymnal is strophic. And so we have to decide, well, what does that mean? I mean, does that mean we really don't have license to undertake readings like this? Does that mean that it's okay to kind of focus on the first verse alone, which is, in fact, what we'll be doing most of our time through this week and what many song analysts do, but it's a wonderful point. And do you have a take? I mean, is your sense that it's kind of cheating to sort of act as though the song only has one verse and, you know, ignore the rest of it?
No. I mean, I write some and it's just a challenge to see how it plays out.
Yep.
Because we often think of that melody corresponding to that first verse.
Right.
Do you work harder to make those things match up, or do you just write what you really need to write?
Yeah.
Let it come out as it comes out.
Yeah. And this famous music philosopher, Peter Keevey, confronts this problem in one moment, and I can't remember which book of his, but he finally just comes out saying, well, you know, we're going to be dealing mostly with first verses, because, you know, who knows the second verse of My Country, 'Tis of Thee? And the fact is, not many of us do. And this is true of most hymns, too, that if we had to kind of, you know, figure out how many hymns we all know the third verse of versus how many hymns we all know the first verse of, you know, most of us know the first verses of most of our favorite hymns. The third verses may be a little tougher to come by, and, you know, there are good rational reasons, perhaps, to say the first verse matters most. But this is, you know, it's a complication we're going to continue living with. Finally, what we're trying to get around to today is a very particular kind of problem that we face in dealing with hymnody. There's a range of issues that might sort of discourage us from looking too hard at things like tone painting in hymnody. One of them is the strophic problem, the fact that we have more than one verse to be sung to a single chunk of music. And another one, which we also confronted last time, is, for example, the problem of translation. Fact that, you know, so many hymns that in the Lutheran tradition we sang began in German have been translated into English, and so we're not really dealing, even in something like a Nicolai hymn, and something like Wake Awake for Night is Flying, the text and tune are by the same guy, you know, and so they're obviously intended to be wedded together, but by the time you translate his German original into English, strange things have begun to happen, even in the, you know, the most responsible kind of translations. So there's the translation problem. Today we're going to confront another sort of broad issue. That problem is the wrong word for it, but a broad issue that one has to negotiate in doing work of this kind, which is the fact that across the whole history of hymnody, texts and tunes tend to get freely sort of intermingled. That in the 19th century, it began to be a popular notion that there was a kind of proper tune for any given text. And there are many texts that end up having, you know, particular tunes associated with them. Chances are very good that only that we all really think of only one tune in connection with Amazing Grace. You know, Amazing Grace is a set of words that has really only a single tune that goes with it. We're probably the same way with Hark the Herald Angels Sing, with Joy to the World, and all kinds of other texts. There are many texts that have only a single tune associated with them, but there are many other texts, probably more texts, that have had various tunes associated with them at different points in their history, and there are many tunes that have been associated with many different texts through their history. And that is the question we want to focus on today. How do we go about sort of looking at what correspondences exist between text and tune in order to start making decisions about why we might prefer this tune as opposed to that tune with this particular text, or what we get out of tune A instead of tune B? We'll look at a few specimens of texts that have been set to more than one piece of music, but then face what is in some ways a much more challenging, much more unsettling problem, which is different sets of words to the same piece of music, and the question whether it's actually possible to hear a piece of music differently according to what words it's associated with. We're going to begin with a kind of slow lob. One of my favorite kind of comparisons of two markedly different tunes that are associated with a single text in many of our imaginations. These are two settings of When I Survey the Wondrous Cross. Thank you. That I, for one, grew up in a Methodist church singing out of that 1966 Methodist hymnal. I knew only one tune to this, the one that we know as Hamburg on the second page here, page 101. But as I grew up, joined the Episcopal Church, I found myself singing Rockingham, the tune on the left, more often. I'd like to sing these two side by side and just ask the question, What do they do for us? What does one do that the other does not? Do they actually end up making us hear the text differently? What can we say about them? And Bjorn, I think I will ask that we begin with Hamburg, that we begin with the one on the right, and then make our way back to Rockingham, the one on the left. Let's sing one verse of each. This, by the way, is an 1824 tune, as we're told in the upper right corner there, by a fellow named Lowell Mason. Many of us will have heard the name Lowell Mason before. He was probably the most influential American musician of the first half of the 19th century. He was a tune book editor and a school teacher. He was the person who, in 1838, kind of hatched this scheme to get music into the Boston public school curriculum. For the first time in American history, music became part of something that kids learned in public schools. And it was Lowell Mason who sort of muscled this through in Boston. He did a lot of teaching himself. He conducted three choirs at different points in Boston. He ran a bunch of singing societies and sort of get-togethers for teachers of music all over the country. And one of Mason's great ambition was to reform American hymnody such that it would be pulled out of that kind of, you know, borderline illiterate sacred harp tradition, the shape note tradition, to which many of us are very attached. I mean, of course, I love a lot of the sacred harp music, that old shape note tradition. But Mason wanted to sort of pull America up out of that toward the European model. This was his goal, to make Americans treat music the way Europeans treated music and to complete the kind of European conquest of American music making. So this is his idea of a good, sound, sturdy tune. What do we get out of this tune? What does Lowell Mason give us? What does he teach us about this text? And again, it may not be a matter of single notes, just on the broad scale. What is this? Is this an effective setting of this text? And if so, why?
It's very solemn.
Very solemn, okay.
I feel like it gives you time to survey the cross.
Great. Great. And in what sense does this tune give you more time than other tunes? I mean, I know exactly what you mean, but what's...
For a poor reader doesn't give you that feeling of dance and moving forward.
Yeah.
I was curious because the alternative is going to be 3/4.
That's right, and we'll come there shortly. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Each phrase ends with a whole note.
The harmonies are very sweet.
Yeah, they are. Other impressions of the whole thing?
It's pretty simple.
It is pretty simple. What's simple about it?
Oh, you don't really jump very much.
No.
Like at all.
Yeah. There's not a leap in the entire thing. That is, the whole thing is stepwise. Da 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 da. Everything is by step. Plus, you don't go anywhere anyway. I mean, that is, the highest note is up here, the lowest note is down here, a diminished fifth, as we call this. This is the narrowest compass. I'm going to go ahead and say this, and then you all can spend the rest of the week proving me wrong. This is the narrowest compass of any tune in the hymnal. I strongly suspect that there is no other tune in this hymnal, the big red ELW, there's no other tune in that book, I'll bet, that has so few notes, that has so small a distance between its lowest note and its highest note. It goes almost nowhere. So there is a sense of solemnity, there is a sense of the sort of rhythmic regularity of the thing, and a sense that there, and there's this kind of sweetness about the harmony. What is the effect of so narrow a compass? The effect of the tune being just so kind of simple and so circumscribed in its motion?
For me, it almost sounded like a rhyme, and I'm surprised by how bright it is.
Like a rhyme?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because
of the
music.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's so simple, but I'm surprised that for me it sounds bright.
That's interesting. There's scarcely any minor chords in it, for one thing. What few notes there are in the major mode, and, you know, it's not necessarily a sad tune, but there is this kind of solemnity about it. And one thing we can certainly say is it is a humble tune. I mean, this is a tune about humility in a certain sense, and a tune that fetishizes humility. Just almost nothing happens. And it's a tune, you know, for people who don't want to draw attention to themselves, or a tune for people who don't want to show off. And I mean, that seems to be, you know, perhaps the most valuable thing it succeeds in pulling out of its text is, you know, I pour contempt on all my pride. I mean, this is the lowliest excuse for a hymn tune that we can imagine, or very nearly so. It is just a very humble affair. With that said, let's head over to Rockingham, which is in fact an earlier tune. Rockingham's written during Mozart's lifetime. It comes from the last quarter of the 18th century. Let's give it a try. Hamburg doesn't, or what can we say about it?
Hamburg is more like a simple chorale, like sophomore music theory.
Yeah.
And this is more like a tune that you might remember in your head or whistle on the way home from church.
Excellent. And this is not a small matter. I mean, the idea of a tune that you might whistle in your head, which is to say a tune that actually gratifies somehow, a tune that actually gives you something musically, I mean, catches your ear somehow. Does that mean it's falling down on the job as far as the text is concerned, or what? How does this stand in a different relationship to the text than the other tune did? Bjorn?
I don't really think that the Hamburg version, that the music really does much for the text, and that you can really pick much out to work them together. Whereas the other one is more like the other ones we've looked at, insofar as there's a lot more to take from the music.
Okay.
You know, there are higher notes or lower notes, there are eighth notes, there are different chords, and 3/4.
Yeah. So what do you take from it, or what does anybody else take from it? I mean, Rockingham, this tune that we just sang. What do we walk away with? What is it?
Well, there's more drama in the way we sing the second one. And mm-hmm. I think of the crucifixion, and it's the drama of the event seems to be emphasized. In the first one, it's more just the humble loss, the humble... Humble somehow keeps coming in,
yeah.
but just loss, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The second one treats the loss as the beginning of more happy optimism and faith. The first one sort of leaves you there with the ugliness of the crucifixion.
Okay. Terrific.
In a way that the Rockingham doesn't, the music doesn't fit the moon. It's looking forward, as Steve says, looking forward to the resurrection already.
Great. This is a wondrous cross, after all. I mean, it isn't a depressing cross or something like that. I mean, you know, it's conceivable, despite the fact that that's practically the only kind of optimistic word in the verse, you know, it's conceivable to say that that's enough. That, you know, that the fact of the crucifixion really is something to be sort of celebrated in, or something to be at least kind of responded to. Jordan, is that a hand going up? Or?
Sort of. Maybe there's another motive for it. I don't know what kind of music Mason wrote, but maybe he was looking for something simpler that people could actually sing a lot better than... The other one seems like, well, it's certainly a lot easier to play, and it's probably easier to sing as well.
Yeah, it is. And that's much of it. And this is actually, I mean, this is something that we see really throughout at least English language hymnody in the 19th century, certainly in the United States, that things, I don't know, things start to get kind of simpler in a certain sense. That in the late 18th century, we find all kinds of hymns that are actually just kind of all over the map, and they make all kinds of demands of singers, of accompanists, and so on. When hymnody really does start to be taken up in the United States by the public, and by the 1830s and 40s, hymnody was the most popular form of popular song that there was. And, you know, if you're going to be selling hymns to all kinds of people, we're going to be sitting around their houses trying to play them themselves, sing them themselves, you know, you have to keep things fairly simple. You have to be sure this stuff is approachable. And this is something I hope we're all vaguely cognizant of, where the history of popular music in the United States is concerned. That hymnody was the big thing through the 1830s, 1840s. It was the best-selling, not only the most popular music at the time, but the most popular music ever. That Lowell Mason's 1841 volume, the Carmina Sacra, was probably the best-selling music publication in the history of the world. He sold about 500,000 copies of the thing at a time when there were only about 23 million people in the United States. I mean, you know, 1 out of 50 people in the United States had gone out and bought a copy of this book. It's a staggering number. So, you know, hymnody is a big seller, and you're absolutely right that it's, you know, thus that we have to be sure that things are sort of simple enough, circumscribed enough, you know, that the public can readily get their hands on it. Don?
These Lenten hymns are really important to me. They're as important to me as Christmas hymns. I mean, I need something to help me in that time to think on it and reflect on it. And I can sing them on my own, just in my day-to-day. I mean, I don't pick up music and sing them, but they come to me during the season of Lent, especially, and Holy Week.
Yeah.
And I think the one that is... The first one we sang is
In the Hour of Trial.
Is a melody that I can carry with me in my head. I don't need music to look at or anything. I know both of them. I've sung both of them in churches all my life. But the one that the first one is the one, if I'm just on my own somewhere in my daily life, that comes to my mind. It's the first tune that I carry.
Very good. And do you think that's because of the nature of the tune, or do you think that's the nature of your experience of them, and you got into one of them first versus the other one.
It could be. I think that it's a simpler melody, simpler
yeah.
something to carry with me in my head.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, and this is another thing that's going to be with us, you know, through the week, is the fact that we all have personal relationships of one kind or another with this music. And I, for one, have a very hard time stomaching new tunes. As a rule, I tend to like things with the tune I grew up with, and often have a very hard time, you know, justifying those decisions one way or the other. But, I don't know. And there are some cases, though, you know, probably few, that are like Donna's describing, when, you know, you have two tunes that may be familiar, that may be nourishing in their ways. But, well, there's frequently one to which I think we'll, you know, tend to turn, as you do to Hamburg. I'm going to move to another couple of pieces here. Chances are good that these will both be fairly unfamiliar. Peace, perfect peace is the text at hand there. A quick show of hands, how many of you can remember the last time you were in a church and you sang Peace, Perfect Peace this hymn? Okay, well, Dawn has. I believe I never have. I believe I've never actually encountered either one of these tunes or any other in the wild. This is something that I've sort of come across in just spending time with hymnals. But this hymn has not survived all that well. This is only the first verse. This is my own transcription of a couple of different settings. This is only the first verse shown here of what is one of the shortest hymn texts that we'll find in the hymnal. There's just almost nothing there where the text is concerned. Peace, perfect peace in this dark world of sin. The blood of Jesus whispers peace within. Just syllable by syllable, this is extremely short. Hymn. And what we're dealing with are two late 19th century settings of this hymn, both in C major, neither one of which, they're not markedly different in terms of their overall stylistic vocabulary, but it's these two hymns with which I want to start sort of honing in on the question of just how tunes might signify differently, of how tunes might really radically inflect our way of hearing a text, because I have a sneaking suspicion that if we are paying close enough attention, these two tunes kind of do. I think these two tunes make rather different arguments about even what this text is about. And the enigma of the text, of course, is just figuring out what that whole second line means. The blood of Jesus whispers peace within. Blood is this that we're talking about? Are we talking about the blood shed on the cross? Are we talking about the blood that we ritually imbibe in the course of the Eucharist? Are we talking about the blood that moved through Jesus' veins when he was a living person? And I think that these tunes finally, you know, the tunes themselves may answer this question a little bit differently. Let us sing the first one, which is, in general, a more popular tune. George Thomas Kaulbach and Charles Vincent's first tune, Pax Tecum. Let's give it a try. Comparatively few notes. How do the words and the notes deal with each other? Any kind of tone painting that we're hearing in this melody, words that are getting sort of pulled out?
Well, the high notes going up to blood of Jesus.
Yeah.
Great. And Sunitha, that's where you were heading.
Whispers goes down.
Okay. Blood of Jesus whispers peace. Good. The whispers sort of backing off, perhaps. And you, the big climb up to blood of Jesus. What's that all about? I mean, what?
Well, that's what it's all about.
Okay. Good. Yeah. And this is a very important thing. I mean, that is that when we sort of cut, you know, we it's like we spend the first half of this text wondering, I don't know, where are we going to find the answer or something, you know, how are we going to solve this peace, perfect peace in this dark world of sin, and then we have this big triumphant sort of climb up to this big high E, the blood of Jesus whispers peace. within. What about the piece itself? Does it proceed?
Well, what you just said resolved for me. I'm a detailed person. I couldn't figure out why the question mark on the text.
Mm-hmm.
That it is the first phrase, you're perplexed.
Yep.
And the second phrase,
you're not sure.
A certainty or
the
answer.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it is, of course, a sentence fragment that's ending with the question mark. There's no verb there. Peace in this art world of sin? It's a question, no verb, but do your best with it. Yeah. And then we have our answer. The blood of Jesus whispers peace within. What about the peace itself? Is that coming across somehow in this musical setting? If so, how? And yes, the answer is yes, or I wouldn't be, asking the question.
Well, it gets a lot of more time.
Stillness.
There's a dotted quarter note there, dotted half note, so it gets more time to linger on the word.
Right. And there's also the fact that the first half of the melody is totally motionless. We have two notes.
Yeah.
Peace, perfect peace in this dark world of sin. We're not going anywhere. We're sort of, melodically static. And then we kind of open up. The blood of Jesus whispers peace within. Okay. And so, the whole first half of the melody is kind of about peace, and the second half of the melody is kind of about this sort of transcendent experience of Jesus. We get our answer, and so it goes. The blood question we'll come back to. Let's see. Bjorn.
One thing to say. The blood of Jesus might be triumphant or what it's all about, but it's also, there's something wrong with it. That doesn't sound very good. So,
great.
Obviously the next tune is minor as well, but.
Yeah. Terrific.
It's not very good.
Can you just play through the blood of Jesus for us? This balancing act that's going on between the melodic victoriousness, whatever you just call it, triumphalism of the melody, versus especially the bass line. The blood of Jesus Christ. That is the fact that we have the sneaking down chromatic thing, that is sneaking down by half step. There's this kind of torment to it, this kind of tragedy to it, the way that it's sort of sneaking down by half step. Since time immemorial, since the Baroque period, the 1600s, if not before, people had used snaking down melodies like that to indicate tragedy. There are many examples, but we won't get into them. But suffice to say, there's a sense in which that's what's being tapped into here. Bum, 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 bum. This kind of bass line tells us a tale of tragedy. But then we get this word Jesus, and that tragedy seems to be kind of over. We've hit a triumphant peak in the melody, and Jesus has sort of carried us beyond, that tragic beginning into a more triumphant frame of mind. This is very important. I mean, this is the story. This is the story the tune has to tell. Yes, there is tragedy, and if it's blood that's bringing on that tragedy, that is, if it's the blood that, places us in a tragic frame of mind, well, then we have to assume this isn't just sort of Jesus being incarnate. This is Jesus being dead or being crucified that we're talking about. This is the blood of tragedy, the blood we associate with tragedy. But then it's, Christus Victor, Christus, Christ, the victorious one who greets us on the other side. When you get into the last couple of bars, everything has been solved with the pronouncing of the name Jesus. Which is to say, the text would appear to be about crucifixion and perhaps resurrection, or at least, the affirmation of the crucifixion. Blood brings with it tragedy, Jesus finally triumphs. That appears to be essentially the musical plot of this melody. Let's sing the other melody and see how it seems to want to go. Time to get it firmly in our ears. Here we go.
dramatic.
How so? Where is the?
Well, it rises up to that E and then comes down. This one is a little bit mellow.
Yeah, and this one never went anywhere. I found this in one hymnal, and it just never caught on.
It's nice.
Yeah, I like it.
Sounds barbershop.
Yeah.
I find the first one like emotional, and I find the second one with colors.
Hmm. How so? Like,
especially where the dark, it was like a darker color. Yeah. So it seemed to have texture and color to it.
Yeah.
Which I find the first one lacks color but has emotion.
That's great. And what was it about the barbershopness of it? This is no laughing matter, and you're absolutely right. I think these are the same observation. That especially in that second line, the melody just sort of gives up. This is a very rare hymn, and having its very highest note come at the very beginning, and then it never approaches that again. It just gets lower and lower and lower and lower.
See, the happiness, my reaction in the second version, is consistent with, at least at my church and probably all of ours, the Eucharist is that moment in time when we seriously go to the table, but the purpose of it is to be enabled to go back out into the world. Sin and this will know that the blood of Jesus is whispering within us, and we should feel enabled and refreshed at the table.
Great. And I guess what intrigues me about this, and I think it wraps up all three of the observations that have just been made. The barbershopness, the coloredness of it, the fact that it tends to be color we dwell on, and the fact that there's something that we walk out with, of the blood being somehow an inward phenomenon. I suspect these are all the same thing, or at least in my experience they are, and they all concern what happens in that magical, you know, 2.5 measures. The blood of Jesus whispers peace with him. You know how we deal with those things. Melodically, nothing happens. There's no climax. This moment, you know, in the sort of, between the 60 and 70% mark, this is where most melodies, would have their climax. Many of them would anyway. This is where the melody backs off to almost nothing. Such rhythmic vitality as there's been goes away. We just sort of trample down to even half notes. The melody stays on one note through the whole thing. The harmony does fascinating things, and the bass just gets blood of Jesus. You know, the bass gets down there in the kind of profundo realm. It's as though something profound is happening. What is that sound? I have a very specific thing that I hear as I make my way through that part of the melody, which is to say, blood of Jesus. I mean, this to me is a pulse. It sounds to me exactly like a pulse. And if we're singing this at 55 beats a minute or something like that, you know, this is how, this is what a pulse sounds like. And to me, when Steve speaks of sort of being made attentive to the blood being within, to the blood being, you know, part of the body, at this point, this is what drives it home so powerfully for me with this melody, is that it's as though we really are being given a bit of tone painting about a human pulse, that this really is the heart pumping this blood. And that at the end of the day, I guess I would like to say that for me, what makes this second melody so markedly different than the first is that it really isn't about crucifixion and transcendence. It's something else, that Jesus arrives sort of transcendently victorious in that first melody. Something totally different is at work in the second one. Something much more specifically, sort of grittily incarnational. That is, that we really want to focus on what this blood moving around in a bloodstream, is like, or what it means, or something like that. And to me, these are just finally very different kind of musical plots that these two simple melodies, you know, have to get across. Closing thoughts on these before we... I want to compare one other pair of pieces. And happily, this is a pair I'd never thought that much about until Dawn sitting in the back row there, and I were chatting a little bit earlier today. These two settings, do I have a hymnal? I've got to get a hymnal myself. There we are. these two settings of There's a Wideness in God's Mercy, 587 and 588. Oh, do we all have hymnals?
Let's see where I get them.
Thank you. I left them sitting out there. When they arrive, we have here in the new hymnal on 587 and 588 two different settings of the same text. There's a Wideness in God's Mercy facing off. Thank you very much. Bjorn, are you scared yet? Is this one going to be a challenge?
I think it's interesting. There's an alternate accompaniment as well.
Okay.
Which seems to be written by someone. Maybe. No, it's by the same.
Okay. Is this going to be? Is 587 going to be survivable? Okay, great. What I would like to do here is sing 588 first. 588, the tune Lord Revive Us is what the tune is called. And this is the tune in the Lutheran Book of Worship, the late 70s hymnal with which many of us will be familiar. It is the 588 tune that it shows up with in the LBW. Let us sing that one first, the one on the right. In the major mode, there's this sort of spirit of affirmativeness about it. For one thing, nothing weird happens, and it's hard to put our fingers on, but the hymn always goes exactly where you expect it's going to go. You know, we do this, we do it again. We have a perfectly well-behaved sort of departure up into the higher realms, as I just said. It's the 60 or 70% mark, where the tune will reach its climax, and then we come back and do that first thing again, A-A-B-A. The entire hymn goes. Nothing untoward happens, no great psychological journey or anything. We're just sort of there in the loving arms of this tune. Now, the words sorrows and failings there in the third line and the fourth line. Sorrows and failings. This feels right, that somehow we should be falling toward the hymn's lowest point for the sorrows, for the failings. You know, there's a kind of psychological, truth to that. But otherwise, I'm with Dawn. It's hard to say exactly what can be said about this tune, except that there's this sort of kindness to it. It's ingratiating. The tune wants to be your friend. It's not trying to push you through the ringer. Let's see what happens with 587, in which our accompanist will be put through the ringer, and we'll see if the rest of us are as well. Good luck, Bjorn. Knock yourself out.
No, I can't play bass notes, so I'll need an organ.
Okay.
That doesn't sound good.
Thank you.
That's awful. Nobody can sing it.
We've been singing it here at Holden all winter, and we started out with a small quartet that sang first two verses, and then taught us how to come into the rest. Mm-hmm. And it's just been the song practically of the year here.
Okay.
It's beautiful.
It's sung slower actually than you played at Bjorn. As a way, it's mostly the same here.
Yeah. So what do you like about it, Don?
Can we try it again? There's the alternate compliment, which would probably be a lot easier.
Yeah, let's give the whole thing a start again from the beginning.
You probably won't get the same feeling, but.
We actually have little notes for the introduction, so we were all expecting the introduction. But you don't have one. We're going to launch right in. Is that how it goes? That's fine. We can skip the introduction and launch right in?
Yeah, let's just skip that.
Good. So. We're skimming it. Here we go.
I'll just give you like four beats and then one, and then you can hit
that's
two.
Great. So you do like it, but it's hard.
Yeah, I think it's difficult for,
kind of grows on you.
Maybe.
Okay.
I suppose if you have the same congregation all the time, they'd finally learn it, but it would change here so much. Yeah.
Terrific. So it is possible for challenging new tunes actually to kind of make a go of it in the right conditions.
When was this tune written?
I'm in there with the rest of you. Here I am looking at the bottom of the page and taking my best guess. 77.
Well,
that's right.
The music, Calvin Hampton, 1938 to 1980.
That's right, but the copyright notice below it, as she has pointed out, GIA claims copyright 1977. And which is to say just about the time the LBW was going to the presses with a different tune in it. But, what does this tune accomplish that the other one does not? In as much as we've been able to make sense of it. I mean, does it teach us things? Does it get at things about the words that the other tune does not succeed in getting at? Thoughts?
I like how justice and mercy is lifted up. It's almost the same. It's the same face of God, mercy and justice, and the tune kind of lifts that up for me.
Mm-hmm. Great.
I think you'd have to live with it for a while to even, it was, many people would be struggling with the notes and the rhythm so much they wouldn't get the meaning of it until they lived with it for a while.
Mm-hmm. Great. Great.
You were talking about hymns being accessible earlier in the
day. Yeah.
And this one would not be an accessible one.
Okay, good. And is that a failing or, well, let's hear.
So there's a more naturalness to the phrasing of it. Like, there's a place to, can't explain it. The music fits the words in 587 more than, and the words fit the music in 588. Like, he's hammering it into a, 588, it's fitting into a very strict form.
Right.
And I think there's more of a naturalness to 587 that appeals to him.
Yeah, terrific. And the tune of 588, for example, we can probably imagine being stuck with other words depending on the circumstances. It's one of those kind of sturdy, blocky tunes that would probably fit other words. It's almost unimaginable to find this, the second tune, the one that we just sung, one we just sang, fit with any other set of words. It fits this set of words rhythmically, everything else, like a glove. I also have to say there's some imponderables that we musicologists struggle with. We have talked already, Sunitha, you've directed our attention to the fact that we have the same kind of melodic gesture for mercy that we have for justice. And of course, the whole first line is the same as the whole second line. It's just that it's been kind of lifted up a little bit. And then we have what's called a sequence. That is, we sing exactly the same thing, but at a higher pitch. Same melody, just at a higher pitch. This always feels profound. Can I have the keyboard again, Bjorn? I'm sorry. I mean, you know, when we think of transcendent love songs through history, it doesn't get any better than Richard Rodgers' My Funny Valentine. Okay, so we have this motto. That's great, catchy enough, that's fine, repeat it three times, it's Richard Rodgers, we'll, you know, let him do it. But, you know, the grand climax, when it comes back, we have to watch it raise sequentially. And it's the saddest thing in the world to see this melody sort of lifted up onto these lofty heights. Something feels profound, you know, when we do this to a melody. And there's just something about that rising sequence. Da 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 bum ba da da ba da 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 da. There's already this kind of built-in sense of, well, I'm not sure what. What is the built-in sense? What is that kind of sequence accomplish? It's like we're going over the same ground, but the ground has been sanctified somehow, or the ground has been elevated. You know.
Sorry.
Fire away.
Sorry. It's kind of like raising melancholy to glory somehow.
Yeah, it is.
I, like this hymn, I've never sung it before, and I sung it in Vespers here a few weeks ago for the first time, and it struck me. I understand people saying it's not accessible, but, yeah. You know, the melody, but it really struck me more so than a lot of other hymns.
Great, great. And this hymn does seem to put before us. Don, did you have more to say? You got everything.
Well, there's just a lead-in on it. That you didn't do the second time, but whatever that little introductory four measures is, it's just amazing how it carefully sets a stage
for
you to when you start singing. I mean, it started long before you started singing.
Yeah.
Things are put in motion.
Yeah.
Somehow.
Terrific.
This may have been said, I'm not sure, but the fact that it may take 10 or 12 times for the average person in the congregation to feel comfortable with the second version requires them to put a little brain power to work on it.
Yeah.
Whereas the first one, which is to me is kind of like a chorale, tends to make people think, well, that's easy. I don't have to.
Yeah.
I don't have to worry about. Reading it or preparing for it.
Yep. There's something about music you actually have to invest something in, that you actually have to, you know, pay attention to. I have to confess, I have never sung this hymn that we just sang in my life, but, you know, we Episcopalians don't do it. It was only Dawn bringing it to my attention this morning that made it, you know, made me interested in putting it before you, but I think it's a nice hymn with which to close, in the sense that it really does, I mean, we're faced with the classic problems here, having a familiar, easy melody and a challenging new melody. And this is a question that, you know, anytime we have two different melodies to the same text, at some point, something like this process took place. Somebody knew one melody and had to get to know another one and had to, you know, learn to accept another one. And that's just an interesting part of the sort of liturgical experience all around. Well, it's been a prolonged enough conversation, we never got around to the second part of this argument. What happens when you fit two different sets of words to the same chunk of music? That itself holds fascinations, and it's possible that when we meet again on Thursday, we will have a chance to tangle with some such cases. Thank you all for today's conversation. I'll see you on Thursday. And thank you, Bjorn, for taking the keyboard. Well done.